Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 63. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Tomorrowland. Joining me are Blaine Grimes and Josh Mayward, two great guys who have a lot of good insights that are polar opposite, but are they polar opposite by the end of the show? Hopefully we'll set a great example of how to look at a movie from a lot of different angles and still have an incredibly positive discussion. Tomorrowland had very little in the way of letting you know what that story was about through its marketing. Most of the hype came from its director and partial writer, Brad Bird, who has done a lot of really great films that made us really excited to see this movie. Even though it wasn't really a splash and critics are divided on if the message rings true or falls flat, there is an idea that this may or may not be a kids' movie, and with that comes a lot of debate on the theme of the movie in general. There's a lot that this movie talks about in regards to objectivism and individuality and how that possibly leads to ideas of escapism. There is a wrestling with being special or recognizing what your gifts are and what your purpose with those gifts are. So we ultimately even get into a discussion about new heavens and new earth. So whether you like the film or didn't like the film, it deals with a lot of really, really cool topics, just like we would expect from a Brad Bird film, and it leads to really great discussion. So here it is, episode 63, Tomorrowland and the New Earth. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Totally.
Because I'm sure you have nothing better to do, because it's only like 6 o'clock there, right?
Yeah, we just had dinner and my kids. So that's one thing, if my kids come in, I'm in my office right now, but if I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and a closed door doesn't necessarily stop them. So if you hear children,
get the chair, wedge it in there.
Yeah.
Don't let them in. I'm so thrilled, that you guys are both free, like right now, to talk about this movie. I have tried to be more flexible. I'm a very like type J person. Like, I have everything planned forever. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that with some of these films, we can try to plan in advance for films that we think are going to be good or we think are going to be bad and skip them. Like last year, I was like, the Lego movie, we're not going to talk about the Lego movie. Even if it's fun, like no one's going to want to listen to an episode about the Lego movie. So, you know, I skip it because I'm already like a month ahead, and then it comes out and people are like, mind blown. This is the best movie of the year, you know, kind of things like that. And so I was like, you know, I need to wrench off this. I need to stop being so rigid. And so I've been trying to kind of go with the flow and only schedule things about a week or so or two weeks in advance, kind of get some buzz from the film, kind of see what people are saying, critics, you know, some of the more trusted Christian reviewers, kind of things like that. So to make sure that when we're not just having talking about a film just because we're talking about a film, but talking about a film because it does actually have good depth to it. Even though we can find theme in anything. So sure. Been trying that. Unfortunately, what that does is that's like last minute scheduling for other people and then trying to switch out a film at the last minute. And so, after trying to get this podcast together, like I said, I can't express how much I am grateful for both of you taking the time to be here, because I was so frantic being like, we can do this movie or this movie and this movie, and I got a podcast to put out by this time, and it was killing me. So I think after I got both of you guys to agree to talk about this film tonight, the next thing I did was schedule all the podcasts out through the middle of July. I'm like, done. Won't have to worry about that anymore. Nice. So, but we are talking about Tomorrowland, and I guess I'm hoping enough people have seen it that they're going to get a lot out of this podcast, because we've, I've talked with both you guys a little bit about this, and I've noticed that even if people don't like the film, they readily admit that there are plenty of themes to talk about.
Yeah.
And, or they just like the film and so they want to talk about it. So I'm hoping that this film in particular will give us a lot to talk about. A Disney film, a Brad Bird film, you know, it's got some star power in Clooney and Hugh Laurie, some semi newcomer, in Britt Robertson. But, yeah. The thing about this film to me was that I had no idea what it was about. Like, especially even watching the trailer, you know, in a world where the trailers are giving everything away these days.
Yeah.
Like, did either of you guys, and actually this is the thing, most of the time I let whoever's on Skype go first. Both of you guys are on Skype. So technically, I guess, Joel, you're further away.
Okay.
So you get to go. But, like, did you have any idea what this film was going to be about when you kind of went to see it?
No, this is one of those movies that I went based on the filmmakers making it. Because I love Brad Bird, and based on the fact that I didn't know what was happening from the trailers. And like you said, there's so many trailers nowadays that give away essentially the entire film, even, you know, climactic, spoilerish moments at the very end of films. And this one really didn't. And that what I really appreciated that. It's, you know, it was the perfect amount of intrigue without giving away too much. So I went into it being like, I think it's about something Disney related, you know, and I know that it's got Brad Bird behind it, and there's some sort of robot thing going on in some of those trailers. But I had no idea otherwise. So I liked that, actually. I went in excited and hopeful.
Well, then I guess I'll ask the follow-up question that, Blaine, you can answer when you answer the other one, too, which is, so... did it meet your, I guess, non-expectations? Like, how did you feel about the film when you were done with it? Like, just, I guess, generally.
How did I feel? I felt, this is one of those movies, actually similar to another Damon Lindelof movie, Prometheus, where I loved the trailer and I didn't really like the film. I thought both of those films, the trailer was more intriguing and fascinating and better edited. And then I got to the end of the film and was like, oh. So I definitely came out of Tomorrowland feeling pretty mixed, to the point of like mixed leaning negative, which I did not expect at all. And I had read some reviews, I guess, before seeing it, like the day before, and they seemed really mixed or negative. So I kind of went in thinking, oh no, this maybe might not be as good as I had hoped. But I kind of tried my best to ignore that a little bit for the sake of Brad Bird. Because I was like, it's Brad Bird. He's never made a bad film. Not even a, like...
not even an okay film.
Right. They've all been great. Yeah. And I Iron Giant, I would consider one of my favorite films of all time. So I went in thinking, how could this go wrong? But...
no,
I was disappointed. So.
Yeah, I was saying, when we did our top five most anticipated of the summer, I remember when I listed Tomorrowland, I think the entire summation of why I was excited, it was like, Brad Bird. Okay, I guess I need to give you more than that.
Yeah.
So Brad Bird directed all these other films. That's what you get.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know nothing about it. But Blaine, so did you have any, like, expectations? What did you think this film, like, or did you have any expectations going in?
So I'm right with you guys and Joel especially. I mean, Brad Bird. I think Brad Bird could probably film a fly on the wall for 3 hours and I would go see it. I love Brad Bird, and I'm with Joel. The Iron Giant is one of my favorite movies ever, and The Incredibles is right up there. So I knew he, you know, when he's on as a director, I know I'm going to go see it, but I didn't have any idea what it was going to be about. And really, really liked that as well in their ad campaign. I guess where Joel and I are going to differ a little bit, and where it's going to be fun to talk about is I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it quite a bit, and it grew on me. And I enjoyed it a lot more after seeing it the second time.
That was what I was going to ask. I was going to ask if you went back and saw it a second time.
And I enjoyed it a lot more that time. So, yeah.
So I've read both of your reviews about this, and I really actually like both of your reviews, even though I would say that they've kind of come to dissimilar conclusions. And that's why I'm really glad that I was able to get both you guys on, because cool. lots of the things that you mention, you saw the exact, it's like you were staring at the exact same picture, and you both came away with a completely different a view on the depth of that picture, the meaning of that picture. And one of the things that struck me was you both talked about kids watching this movie in very different ways. So I would ask you both to kind of expand on that. And the question being, Blaine, you can start this time. Like, is this a kid's movie?
Yeah, I think it is fundamentally a kid movie. I mean, it's got all those things that you expect or you see in kids movies, especially kids movies of old. I think a lot of it kind of harkens back in spirit to old Spielberg films, or more recently Super 8, which was basically just, you know, Abrams' love letter to Spielberg.
Yeah,
I mean, because it's got these bike rides at night, these secret missions. The main character, you know, as much as Clooney brings to the film, and Hugh Laurie, I mean, it's grounded in these, you know, characters that are kids, even though one of them is a robot. So yeah, I think fundamentally at heart it is a kids movie, but it's also a kids movie in the same way that every other Pixar movie is a kids movie, where it's not like, I mean, you're always aiming at a broader audience, and it's got. Mm-hmm. I think it's got themes, and it's got ideas, and it's got just cool things in there that that are clearly there for adults as well.
I was going to say, you're not the only person that I noticed that likened it to Spielberg. I definitely had another reviewer, another review that I really liked that was kind of differing from my own opinion, but they brought up like Indiana Jones, kind of that adventure.
Yeah.
Not magic, but like this, like youthful discovery, like the world is bigger than you think it is. It was interesting to see so many people latch onto that, but then, so I turned the conversation to Joel. Joel, is this a kid's movie?
I would actually say that it's not a movie intended for kids. And that was the thing that I was really surprised by, is I felt like the filmmakers were confused about their audience. And so I can see those adventure elements and can see kind of the Spielberg Amblin Entertainment kid-like adventure, maybe similar to like the Goonies or something like that, where these ordinary kids are kind of taken up in this extraordinary journey. But I felt, for being a PG-rated Disney film that's supposed to be about, you know, it's based out of Tomorrowland, which is based out of Disneyland, which is one of the happiest places on Earth. it's pretty dark in tone and has a significant amount of violence, like more than I anticipated. And while most of that violence is robot-related, some of the scenes were just... overly long fight scenes with robots, or I think of the scene in the nostalgia sci-fi shop, which I loved. I would have just liked a movie about that shop. That was great. But then when they're fighting and these robots are trying to genuinely kill her, and then the later robots kill policemen, I don't know if you want to get into spoiler territory, I suppose, but, you know, so Governor Nix at the end, just the way that he's crushed, his legs are crushed. He tries to kill George Clooney. And so similar kids movies, I guess, like I can think of the violence in them, but this one felt darker to me. And particularly the scene that got me is when Athena is hit by a truck and they show it. That's that kind of jump scare. She's walking along and a truck hits her and drags her body along the road. And you know she's a robot, I think, by that point. Or at least, you know, there's a suggestion that she's a robot.
Yeah.
Or some sort of... She's not fully human, at least. But it's a young girl being graphically hit by a vehicle and showing the entire thing. And And I was, if I had brought my son, I know he would have flipped out. Mm-hmm. Like he would not have liked that part at all. And I think even some of the messages, well, I get that their ideas are really interesting and complex, and we'll probably get into some of that too. I felt like some of those messages would be totally lost on some kids. This idea of, you know, media and the time travel and sending these messages, they weren't as clearly I was still kind of wrestling with what they were about. And so I imagine if you're 6, 7, 8, you might not grasp to what was actually going on with some of those messages the same way that you would with a Pixar film like Wall-E or Up or the Toy Story films. You know, Wall-E, we need to take care of the world. And I think that's a good contrast to this film. We take care of the world. We go back to it and we save it and help it. Mm-hmm. And this, and Tomorrowland's more like, I think people are special. Be more special.
Well, I was going to say,
so yeah,
when it comes to like the, oh, I don't even know if you call it like the plot device of the film, like the what they're trying to stop or whatever. I want to be like, yeah, I think definitely kids couldn't understand exactly what was happening, because I totally couldn't. I was like, I leaned over to my wife. I was like, I don't understand which way are they going? Who's the bad guy? Because it took me a while to keep up with that. And I imagine that would be hard for, I guess, most younger kids. And I think that's a good contrast. You know, even though most Pixar films deal with what I would consider weighty topics, weighty mm-hmm. themes, weighty issues going on in the world, I think they don't really make those really too difficult for a kid to grasp. So I think that's a good comparison. What I would do is kind of agree with you by saying that I was also appalled. Well, not appalled. I was surprised by the amount of violence in a PG film. Mm-hmm. Like I was like that really kind of like I didn't expect it a lot of the time, especially when you point out like Athena getting hit by the car. That was like, that seems a little much for PG. I mean, PG is to me like basically live action films that should have been probably animated or something. You know, it's like mm-hmm. like a Disney TV show or something. So what I would kind of push back is getting a clarification from you on, Blaine mentioned Super 8. Like, would you think Super 8 is a kid's movie?
Ooh, good question.
Because I mean, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
I think, okay, first of all, MPAA ratings don't necessarily make or break whether a movie is a kid's movie or not, right? And so
great point.
PG-13 movie, I can think of PG-13 movies that would be totally fine for kids, and I can think of ones that wouldn't be fine at all. Mm-hmm. And same thing with PG films. I can think of ones that their themes or messages wouldn't be appropriate for children, and other ones that, you know, are totally fine. So that can't be, you know, the final determining factor, but it is something to consider when determining, do I take my child to see this or not? And what are some of the things that are involved in this film? So to answer the question, is Super 8 a kid's movie? I'd say yes and no. I think both films, and I think Blaine hit on this, is that they both try to achieve a sense of childlike wonder and that sense of there's something bigger to this world and awe-inspiring, and even maybe that kind of hopeful, innocent optimism of childhood. And both are trying to achieve that. But I think Super 8 actually does that, ironically, better than Tomorrowland, even though it's got some darker and more violent things that are going on in it. So I guess I'm thinking back to Super 8. I haven't seen the film in a while. I definitely wouldn't let my son watch it or something like that.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty intense at some points with some of the action sequences. Yeah. But it's akin to the Goonies in terms of, this is something that would be frightening maybe to my son's age. But if you were 9, 10, 11, it would be probably really fun.
Yeah.
And one of those kind of entry into adult world kind of films. And so that's kind of what I think these films are trying to do, is trying to be those films that bridge childhood and adulthood or childhood and adolescence, maybe.
Yeah.
But that's a difficult line to walk, I think, when it comes to filmmaking.
Which, so it's commendable, but maybe not, in your opinion, didn't really pull it off this time.
Yeah, so in my opinion, I don't see Tomorrowland, and I know that others have seen this. Like, I know that the goal is to try to be optimistic and hopeful, but I didn't leave Tomorrowland feeling that sense of childlike wonder.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that I did actually in Super 8. Like, some of those things made me feel like a kid again. And Tomorrowland, when I left, I didn't feel as much like a kid again.
Hmm.
So that could have been my own personal bias and my own personal experience. But that was the sense I got when I left the movie, was more of kind of a huh and a disappointment than a whoa, that was, you know, the visuals or this other world or getting caught up in that adventure story. So
I guess I would throw it back to you, Blaine. Like, you gave us like a, I would say, a pretty intro. You think it is kind of a kid's movie, but then, you know, when Joel's kind of expounding upon it, talking about not getting that sense of wonder and things like that, like, would you say that it gave you that sense of wonder? Did it leave you with that, and you think it's a kid's movie, or it's just something for all ages, but didn't necessarily resonate on that level?
Yeah, this is one of the things I love about movies, is two people can walk out of the same movie and experience completely, you know, opposite things. Because I did. I kind of got a similar feeling to what I did with Super 8. And mm-hmm. It gave me... Now, at the same time, it gave me more to think about than I think a film like Super 8 or The Goonies does. So there was also kind of a contemplative side to it of, you know, trying to piece all the narrative things together that may not have been explained as well as they could have been.
Yeah.
And just trying to make sense of all that and everything. But still... it was all kind of undergirded by this backbone of this childlike joy and awe in how Brad Bird was able to execute his vision. And, you know, it's interesting to go back for a second, talking about the violence in the film, if I can.
No, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because I was thinking about that, and I don't have kids, so I guess I wasn't thinking about that quite as much. But it is fairly violent, and it's and intense for, you know, if you want to call it a kid's movie. And I guess one of the things that I find interesting about that I guess initially I would say I even kind of appreciate is how Bird seems to be willing to do, to confront even young viewers with reality.
Mm-hmm.
In his films. I think you see that, you know, going all the way back to The Iron Giant. You certainly see it in The Incredibles. And I kind of appreciate that in the children's literature that I like the most. I think even about some of the stuff C.S. Lewis has said in an experiment in criticism about how fantasy stories aren't supposed to take you away from reality. They're supposed to make you confront it, even children. And so I guess I'm even kind of drawn to the fact that, yeah, when I think about it, it was scary because you felt like this girl might get killed. I mean, and these other robots were trying to kill her. And I guess I appreciate that in a way, that a filmmaker is willing to do that in a kid's story and make the stakes real. Where it feels like something's at stake in this.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just kind of sit back and say, oh, well, it's all going to work out all right in the end, even though, yeah, it probably is. I appreciate him being willing to do that.
Yeah, I would say that's probably what in this film reminded me most about. We like I said, we keep mentioning Goonies and Super 8, like, and you know, we could even argue that those are again very similar movies. Like in those movies, I remember them being kids' movies or like for, you know, younger audiences. But the stakes in them always started out pretty heavy, you know, like someone's going to like lose a house or there's a, you know, there's family strife, family loss. Like it's all pretty heavy. And I was like, I just don't feel like I see a lot of kids movies that deal with that, at least to where it's that acknowledged, not like an animated Disney movie where it's like, you don't have any parents, but no Disney people have any parents, so that's okay. We'll just say that as an aside. But trying to deal with that like they do in Super 8 or Goonies, and I, like here there's like a heaviness to it. Like everything's not perfect. We live in a really kind of jacked up world, and I think without showing that world that is rough around the edges or even worse, then it makes it harder for Tomorrowland to do what it eventually, like I said, we can argue that it tries to go on to do, whether it succeeds or not. And I kind of want to focus on Brad Bird for a second, because I didn't really realize this at first, but Brad Bird has had some, I guess, criticism leveled against him. And this goes along the lines of Joel mentioning how, you know, we just need to find the special people and then let them be more special and, you know, push them off into special land so they can continue to increase their specialness. Mm-hmm. There's this criticism that's been leveled against Brad Bird that he has some kind of influence from Ayn Rand objectivism. Like mm-hmm. most of his films seem to have strong themes of individuality. I mean, even to a lesser extent, The Iron Giant, but the Incredibles and Ratatouille, like these people that are special needing to have room to be special, and that makes them kind of superior. I don't necessarily buy that as cut and dry as some of the people who level those criticisms do, but how do you feel, or where do you feel Tomorrowland kind of landed in either adding or taking away from that criticism of Brad Bird? And again, you guys can do paper, rock, scissors for
I'll let Joel go on this first.
Yeah. First off, I'm not familiar enough with Rand's theories to make like a, you know, super informed statement about it, but I have read similar criticisms about that. And I've had to go back and revisit some of that, like thinking about and reading through some of my writings on Iron Giant in particular, but then thinking through Ratatouille and not as much Mission Impossible, I think, but the Incredibles, that idea of being special and set apart.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of see it in Mission Impossible too. You know, these are this elite squad that's special and beyond, you know, all the other government agencies and everything. But I don't know that, I don't think that theme is there or would have been thought of or present until Tomorrowland was made. And then you can retroactively go back and maybe try and make that claim by basing it on some of those other films.
Mm-hmm.
But Tomorrowland itself has so... I could see how that claim could be made about it as a film. I don't think you could make it necessarily about all of Brad Bird's films, and that there's this underlying theme that he's trying to kind of force his way in each narrative that he's presenting.
So Tomorrowland to you is, if anything, the epitome of this, so much so that it might make you look at his older films with a different lens.
Yeah, I feel like the other films, their themes and their messages were shown in the story itself, where Tomorrowland feels so didactic and heavy-handed to me at times, especially with Governor Nix's long monologue near the end about, you know, this is what, basically, here's everything that's wrong, here's how to make it right, I'm the bad guy and let me explain that, and and then even just the word optimism in the screenplay is thrown out there so much from the get-go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
let's turn over to Casey's character and she says, I'm optimistic about everything, and that's so at the end of it, it just felt so heavy to me, where you can get some of those different themes and ideas out of Ratatouille and out of The Incredibles, and I guess out of Iron Giant as well. Those stories are a bit more layered and nuanced to me, where Tomorrowland ended up at the end just kind of being a, man, this is going to be strong, but kind of a propaganda piece for okay. this idea of optimism and positivity. And if you just have more positive thinking, everything will be okay. So that was the message that I ended up getting out of it. I don't know how you could not get out of it. Like they kind of drill it in by the end. So that, I know that sounds kind of cynical about a pretty positive sounding film. But I felt like those previous films are so much more positive than this one because of their stories.
Well, so I guess that's the thing. Where is on that seesaw, where is the difference? Is it because this one is too violent? Is it just does the tone too dark to actually come off as an optimistic piece? Is it too focused on individual achievement or individual optimism? Like where does it veer off that road?
I think for me, it veers off in just the way it tells the story. I think it at the end, again, with Governor Nix's message, and when they defeat everything, I guess the way I interpreted and understood the film is that Tomorrowland, first of all, is not Earth. It's another dimension and another time. And so the recruitment program of Tomorrowland that started by Governor Nix and then, strangely enough, taken up by Frank and Casey, so they just replaced Governor Nix doing the exact same thing, is recruiting all the dreamers and special people away from the Earth to go to this special place, because the Earth in and of itself is so negative and bureaucratic and jacked up that the only way that you can really accomplish anything of worth is by getting away from it. And they don't, as far as I can tell from the film, and Blaine, you might be able to speak into this because you've seen it twice. I don't recall them ever sending people back from Tomorrowland to go fix or help or heal the world. They just take them away from the world. And actually, in some scary ways, if you think about Frank is taken away from his family. Who raises him in Tomorrowland? Like he's an 11-year-old kid, I think, who's just suddenly, I mean, this is a strong word, but he would be kidnapped or manipulated into going to Tomorrowland to go be a special person. That's pretty disturbing to me if it comes down to it, and ends up being more of a kind of a secular left behind is something I wrote on Twitter. There's no God involved in this. They don't take any of the You don't see any pastors or theologians, or priests or anybody of any sort of religious bent in the end being taken away from the world, because those people don't necessarily help it. They won't be able to fit into Tomorrowland's dreamers. But they do take musicians and some scientists and other interesting people like that, to get away from the negativity of our world to be in a more positive, otherworldly place.
When you say it like that, it makes it sound terrible.
I know, and I hate being like I feel like I'm so cynical about it, or come across as cynical because I viewed it that through that lens. And so when I hear people talk about how it's optimistic and positive, I don't want to be the guy that's like, no, let me show you just how bad this really is. But I also don't want people to be taken in by a false optimism or a false sense of hope or false positivity. That sounds good initially, but then when you really start to uncover it and think about, wait, what are Frank and Casey doing at the end with all these robotic kids? And who are these people that they're taking away? And what is going to happen to the Earth now that they've taken all the dreamers away? That starts getting a little less positive. And I guess connects to the child movie thing too. That doesn't feel like a message I'd want to send to my children either.
Well,
Sorry, I've talked a lot, but
I was going to say
let Blaine
it's
go.
definitely sounds like the argument of someone who's just jealous that they're not in Tomorrowland.
I know. I'm a pastor and I got skipped over, so
Okay, so Blaine, I'm hoping you've been biding your time. Like I said, there's like, do you feel kind of, or at least do you get what Joel's saying about some of like the optimism and the focusing on the individual, and maybe like, would you even see Tomorrowland promoting escapism, possibly?
Okay, yeah, I can talk about that for a few minutes. A couple of caveats. I think Joel's made some great points, and I hope I can highlight those points where we agree, because there's quite a few of them along. I think even though I'm more positive about this movie, I mean, I don't want it to come across as I'm like I'm endorsing the kind of optimism that seems to be taught in this film, because as a Christian, I don't.
Can you?
So when I talk about the movie optimistically, it's not like I agree 100% with all of this, but so I think that's a fair point. And I hadn't really thought about some of the stuff you mentioned there, Joel, at the end. And thinking about the preachiness of the movie, because I thought about that a lot too, because it's there, right? I mean, you can't ignore it. And that's one more of those things that kind of makes me think this movie is targeted at kids, because Bird's not an idiot, and he's not a bad screenwriter, and Lindelof's not an idiot, and he's not a bad screenwriter. And yeah. Well, okay, so I haven't seen Lost. Okay, so not as familiar with Lindelof, but I mean, you're saying they're really not very good if they're just being this, like, this heavy-handed toward an adult audience. I mean, this is kind of what makes me think that that some of this is for the kids. Because it would be so, like, if it's subtle, if it's hinted at, it would be way harder than it probably already is for kids to get. So I'm not even sure they succeeded, if this is what indeed they were trying to do with all of the monologuing and the preachiness. But that's one way I've kind of tried to think about what they may have been doing and adding all of that in. But I don't know. So there's my 2 cents on that. As for the second question was about escapism.
Yeah, like, does Tomorrowland, if it's just taking all these people to Tomorrowland, are they just escaping this terrible world? Like, is that the goal?
Yeah. So this was something I picked up on a lot more the second time around. I really do think that this is a movie that's meant to be enjoyed multiple times. It's so much more fun when you know when you go into it knowing what's going on, right? We talked a little bit about the ad campaign already and how there was this sense of mystery built in. And I would actually argue that when that sense of mystery is removed and you come back to it already knowing what's going on, it's much more enjoyable and things are much more clear. Not to say it's perfect. There are plenty of rough spots. Joel pointed a lot of them out. But I think it's a lot more clear. And one of the things they mention in several places that I don't know that I picked up on as much the first time is that Tomorrowland is another dimension. But the entire point of Tomorrowland is to eventually be able to make it public and actually implement some of the things they invent into the real world. So it seems like the entire goal, I know, what's her name? Athena. Athena's character mentions that a couple of times, and Frank mentions that, that they're trying to go public with all of this. In fact, that's what the pens were for initially that Frank got in 1964, was it was a preview, right? It was a preview of Tomorrowland to get people in so that they could then make it public. I think there's still some problems with that, like Joel mentioned. But yeah, I don't think it's just sheer escapism, because their goal seems to be to help people. And again, at the end of the film, if all Clooney and Athena, or well, Athena's dead. What's her name? Cassidy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Casey.
Yes, thank you.
So Cassidy's the girl who plays Athena.
Raffi Cassidy is the girl who plays Athena. Yeah, but if Casey and Frank are just basically replacements for Governor Nix, well, that's a huge, it could be, but that's a huge oversight in screenwriting on the part of Bird and Lindelof. I mean, that's a huge hole. You would think things like this would get worked out. It seems like they're trying to build this back up and make Tomorrowland what it was originally intended to be, which is a way to perfect the world, to save the world. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's even what Nix says when Casey finally gets to Tomorrowland. She's like, what's going on? What's going on? And he says, and Nix says to her, well, he thinks you can save the world. So all of this does seem in a roundabout way to be about perfecting and saving, or saving first and then eventually perfecting the world. So I don't know that I would agree entirely that it's escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And even I like that it, secular Left Behind. I think,
but that makes it sound worse.
I don't know. I guess I would want to, I guess just from my answer, I would push back against that a little bit, because the goal does seem to be to save the world. Whereas it seems to me, well, this is real world theology, so I guess we can talk this a little bit.
Oh yeah.
Like, it seems like dispensationalism, sorry, anybody is one. It seems like it's so pessimistic, at least about the here and now, right? You need the world to go to hell in a handbasket so that Christ can return, because he's not going to do it before everything goes south. So, like, that seems really pessimistic to me. And I don't know that I got that from, I mean, Bird's vision has, you know, his humanism has its own problems. But I don't know that I quite got that. Like, to me, Left Behind really is escapism. But I don't know. I just don't know that I got that completely, because that emphasis is there on we're fixing the world. We're saving the world. I mean, that even seems to be what Casey is all about, right? You see her in the English class when they're going through some of that preachiness of all the teachers talking about doomsday and destruction and all that, which really isn't that far off of reality. I mean, I sat through plenty of graduate seminars, and it's really pretty close. I mean, we sit, you know, I've sat in seminars, and we're all sitting there talking about how bad the world is and how sad it is. And, you know, we're in this white middle-class setting lamenting, you know, how bad we have things.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, but Casey's all about what can we do to fix it?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't seem like Casey would be on board for this. We're going to this utopia now and you know, forgetting everyone that's
well, I guess I would disagree about that, about Casey and her character too, and that was one of the things I struggled with as well. I guess let me back up a little bit. I do think probably the fault in the script is with Lindelof and not Bird, just based on their track record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I look at Damon Lindelof's films and even Lost, I think he is very good at coming up with intriguing and interesting ideas that have a lot of complex themes, and then he can't stick the landing.
Yeah.
I don't feel like, I think he starts off well. Every movie that he's done starts off great, and yeah, then he can't finish or close it.
Yeah, you're super interested in it.
And you could just see that theme keep on going. Anyway, with Casey, the one thing I struggled with is, for all her optimism, I wondered the whole time, first of all, what makes her so special? Like, the only thing I could tell is that she just knows how things work. That's how the film describes it. And she fixes her dad's machine that he can't fix, and then she can understand the weird ball globe time travel thing in Tomorrowland, and she knows that better, you know, without any training. And she seems like she's just really chipper and positive. And so she makes the, you know, the 100% doom device drip, you know, drop down to 99%, I think, just by her proximity or something she says or something like that, right? So she has this somehow powerful optimism that can do that. And that's cool. But I wondered, for somebody who's got all these gifts and she's posing that question in her high school class, you know, so what are we going to do about it? I would be like, so Casey, what are you doing about it?
Yeah.
And she would respond, well, I'm sabotaging NASA equipment, lying to my dad. And actually I am escaping or abandoning my family, my dad and my younger brother, so that I can go see this world because I just absolutely have to. That actually takes precedence and is more important to me in the end. And yeah, I come back and I get them later. But for Casey's character to do that, I guess that made me wonder a little bit about her too, just what made her so special and why. Is she a protagonist worth cheering on or emulating in mm-hmm. some ways?
Yeah. So, I want to say this about her character, because there are a lot of things about her that I did not care for, but when you asked, and when I got this question from reading your review of it, like, you know, what basically makes her special? And sometimes one of the hardest things in being a planner of things or an organizer of things is that you come against people who are just negative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this goes back to kind of, even though it was really, really on the nose, that little fable or whatever she told about the two wolves. Like, I feel like currently it is way easier in our society to point out the negative and never really have any kind of optimism or positive thing to add to the conversation. And if nothing else, she is the person that I would want giving me constructive feedback, because she's not just like, that's broke. She's like, that's broke, but what can we do? Can it be fixed? Can we move on? Let's work towards something better, as opposed to, like I said, what I get most of the day. You know, can we do this? No, this is a terrible idea. Well, what would be a better idea? I don't know. Or, hey, did you like that? It was all right. Well, what would you have done different? I don't know. I think people are feeding that darkness and despair because it's easier, which I think has a lot of spiritual undertones to it. It's a lot easier for us to feed that wolf, so to speak. Mm. And the thing I like about, I like about her character is there is this wonder. Is there a world that, she's asking these questions in class. Can it be fixed? Can it be fixed? And no one is giving, like, most of the time, no one's even letting her talk. So yeah. When she sees a place that looks like it is fixed, to me, it seems like they're trying to express that she, for the greater good, is trying to find a place that has the answers to her questions. And by getting those answers, she's going to eventually do something, again, for the greater good. She doesn't want to just leave her family, like, forever. She said she'd be back. You know, she's not really trying to sabotage NASA just because she doesn't like NASA. She's trying to, sabotage this destruction equipment so something that incites wonder doesn't get destroyed because of budgetary or political reasons. Like, I see her motives as positive and her actions as questionable, but I think what makes her special is like the fact that she has a desire to help and a belief that it's not broken forever. And I think that's something that is more rare than not, even in Christian circles, because we get to mm-hmm. that Blaine was talking about, that idea that lots of Christians have. I mean, we might not know any personally because we probably come from theological backgrounds that, say we should have a peace here and look forward to what's to come. And not just, why did I get saved? I got saved so I could die and go directly to heaven. That's like that old question. Like, when you get saved, why do you not just like kill over dead and go be with Jesus? Because there's other work to be done. And I like that concept that in this movie, Tomorrowland's heroes kind of seem like they're trying to help fix the world, not necessarily save it, even though Nyx accuses them of trying to save it. And the difference between it being escapism wholly and like some kind of pursuit of individual happiness is that it's almost completely other focused. Because I picked up on this thing, like, they kept trying to make it public, kind of what Blaine said as well. Now, for whatever reason they didn't, do they have a good reason not to have made it public? This is all questionable and things that bothered me about the film. But I was under the impression that they were taking the people in a place where they were away from distraction. They're away from the politics that hold things up, giving them free rein to come up with ideas to fix the world. And they were going to bring those ideas back kind of unfettered. So I guess I had a slightly different, I'm hoping I'm somewhere in the middle, guys. Like, my entire spiel is hoping I'm somewhere in the middle, like seeing kind of how that came out. But doing that, I completely just got on like a I'm probably being generous saying 7-minute rant that completely interrupted Joel. So Joel, if you can even remember what you're talking about, please continue.
Oh no, I First of all, that's really good. And I think it's good to see, and I think Blaine has said this too, how different people can interpret a movie in a different way. And I actually think that's one positive aspect about this film, is how its ideas are big enough, the things that it proposes are big enough that people find themselves reacting to it, and maybe even reacting to it strongly and in different ways. But in some sense, it actually does its job well of being this message of, hey, do something about it. Because you can't just sit back, take it in and say, yeah, that was kind of a fun, entertaining ride, and now I just leave and don't think about it ever again. So I guess the hard part for me is that I would actually view myself as kind of this naive, optimistic idealist. And so when a film like this brings out more of a negative response in me, there's this internal wrestling with me too, because I think it's easy to dismiss even some of the things I say about it as being like, well, you're the cynical guy that Tomorrowland isn't for. Like, you're the one that's not, you, clearly you're not getting the picture.
Yeah, you're not getting the picture or a button. You're not getting
Yeah, exactly. Actually, at my screening, they handed out Tomorrowland buttons. So I do actually have a legit physical Tomorrowland button, because I'm special, apparently. But what I was longing for, I guess, for Casey, and maybe Casey and Frank's relationship, and they explore it a little bit. You know, I said that she doesn't actually use her gifts to fix things in her world, and she does it just to sabotage expensive equipment. I was hoping that there would be some sort of redirection and mentorship, and maybe even like an admission that in some ways she was missing the point.
Mm-hmm.
And that she and Frank could kind of learn from one another, because he's a pretty cynical guy by the time she meets him.
Oh, definitely.
He's kind of this cantankerous old, you know, it's probably one of the least charming, least positive Clooney roles I've seen, where he's not the, you know, at least even in his negativity, kind of charming and upbeat. Like, he's just kind of sour the whole time. And Casey and Athena are, you know, kind of his foil, his positive foil. And I was hoping that they would have the kind of banter that they had right at the get-go, you know, when they're kind of sharing their story and she's interrupting him, and
mm-hmm.
this kind of back and forth, positive, negative, you know, optimism, pessimism kind of thing, and find somewhere in the middle that's where we need to meet. We have this reality that we're in, a broken world, and it is messed up, but this also reality that we have an obligation to fix it. And to fix it, we stay in that world, maybe. I would have hoped for a message like that, that we don't just abandon our world because it's so messed up, and then we can come back later to fix it. But that we can stay in the messiness of our world and maybe bring more of Tomorrowland to the earth instead of we take other people out of it. I'm not sure if that makes sense, and maybe this is just me like wishing and dreaming for a different script, and that's probably reading too much into the film. Or taking it places it was never intended to go.
No.
But that was that would be what I, if I could have more of an idealistic, optimistic message, the way that I would have framed that story.
So that takes me kind of like to what I guess I want to be almost the last question. And I hesitate a little bit because I definitely don't typically approve of people putting their own themes in a movie that's not there.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially when Christians use, like a 2-minute clip of a movie to, mm-hmm. to express some type of point that the movie was never trying to make. So I do this with some hesitation, but I do kind of want to hit a theological kind of idea, that I think is going to be a discussion piece, because you've already started talking about it. And based on other conversations we've had, we're all kind of dancing around it. And so this is a bit of a rhetorical question, but so like Tomorrowland plays with this idea that the world is ending. They say it's certain, it's unavoidable, it's coming. And so for us, that's not something that's theologically foreign. So while Tomorrowland suggests that we can possibly, and I kind of quote, like, fix the world, as Christians, what do you think our part in, I guess, engaging or fixing the world should be? Like, I mean, we're eventually going to go to the new Earth, but while we're not there, what should our role be here? Silence.
Well, I'm not going to answer before the pastor, so.
You got to set the bar.
No, it's a good question. I guess one thing first, too, is I've really appreciated, Blaine, I've appreciated your perspective, and it's making me have to rethink a lot of things and makes me want to revisit the film. And I think I've appreciated even just our discussion that we can come out on totally different sides and yet still engage with the film and one another in a way that's really positive. And that's a positive.
What are you talking
thing.
About? I can't stand you.
Yeah. All this, guys, all this grace and reconciliation is starting to get on my nerves.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess, like, to answer the question about what do we do, and if you want to take this kind of message of optimism and hope, I guess one thing that Christians do have is they can say they have a genuine hope. It's not just to pick yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, pat yourself on the back and tell yourself it's going to be okay. And you really don't know if it is, because of what Jesus has done for us on the cross, and he's defeated death and brings about resurrection and new life. We can actually say with confidence that there is hope, even in a broken and messed up world, while also recognizing that we do need to be in that world, just as Jesus comes in the incarnation. You know, it's not this long distance fix it solution kind of thing where God sends us his plans or sends us his special technology from far away, but he comes into the midst of it and walks with us as one of us. And I think that's something that I was hoping more for a Tomorrowland type of film, is just being willing to deal with some of that messiness. And it does a bit, it wrestles with some of that a bit, but by the end, it still has that kind of otherworldly optimism. And I guess I would have preferred a redeemed this worldly optimism, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And so I think that kind of positivity feels more genuine, and that kind of hope feels more genuine when we can wrestle with the reality that our world is a broken place, but there is some sort of genuine hope because the savior that we have isn't just ourselves and our own technology and our own positive thinking, but somebody outside of ourselves has entered our mess to save us from it and redeem it. There you go.
Yeah.
That's my thought.
No, that's
good. It's kind of a devotional thought at the end, I suppose, but.
So Blaine, how would you suggest that we, like I said, kind of engage with the world knowing that it's not permanent?
I'll say I don't know, and then I can talk about it a little bit. I don't have this all figured out at all by any means. Are you still there? You still
here? Yeah, go ahead.
Cool. Okay. So I think one of the things that I love what you had to say, Joel, about the incarnation, and I think that's formative. And I just think also as Christians, we recognize that Jesus is king now, and that the world is in his control, right? We believe that God is sovereign, so he's actively in control of all things at all times. And I'm also kind of one of those guys who leans toward, we engage with the world, right? I'm obviously not advocating any sort of escapism. We're a faithful Christian presence in the world. We're supposed to be active, doing good, loving our neighbor. At the same time, I recognize as a Christian that I'm not the one who's going to fix the world. I do good. I love God and I love others, but I realize that ultimately Christ is going to bring the kingdom and he's going to usher that in. I mean, it's an active living as a Christian under God's reign. And I guess that's the most succinct way that I can put it. And I agree with what Joel said.
No, that's good. I think both those things are really important to keep in the back of our mind, because I think the strongest two tendencies that I see are for people to either run away from it, which, you know, we get that in sermon illustrations all the time, right? The castle mentality. Let's go find our Christian friends. Let's go only listen to Christian music, do Christian things, and it's not our business. God's either going to take care of it or he's not, so let's stay over here. And then the other one that's like, yeah, I've got to fix everything. It's all on me. Having very little hope or trust that God's also at work in it, believing that, you know, the ultimate burden is like, if I don't get out there and I don't do X, Y, and Z, then this person's never going to know Christ, or this social issue is never going to be solved. And it's neither of those kind of extremes. It's like this tandem understanding of who God is and how his creation works and what our part in that is. And at least from what I'm hearing, both of you are, hitting on that. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like we are all kind of coming from a similar place. So, like I said, it was a bit of a rhetorical question, because I don't honestly believe that Joel, either you or Blaine, would be on this podcast talking about a secular movie if we all didn't agree that we should be engaging in those conversations and in that world. So,
yeah.
With that, we do the true wrap up, which means that we talk about our least favorite and most favorite moments. And I'm sure that, unlike some films that we've had the pleasure of doing recently, there will be a couple eye rolls in this film. So, Joel, what would you say was your biggest kind of come on moment? Like, just made your eyes roll, or you just like really just didn't do it for you?
I think the entire Eiffel Tower sequence, which I imagine was supposed to inspire and instill wonder and kind of felt almost National Treasure-esque, like those films, you know. But when they walk in and there's this, you know, recreation of Tesla and Edison and these mannequin figures, I'm like, what is going on right now? And why? And it's a rocket? And they, I mean, it's kind of cool again in a kid-like sort of way, but by the end of that, it takes a long time too, and so by the end of that sequence I was like, just get to Tomorrowland, come on, just get there already. So that was my eye rolling kind of check my watch moment in the film.
And a fine selection. All right, Blaine, what was it for you?
The eye roll moment. Are we doing favorites now, or
just the eye roll, or just the come on?
Okay, just the come on. I don't know that this was a just come on as much as it was a what's going on type thing. At times, the pseudo romance between Frank when he's older and Athena, it was kind of creepy.
Yeah,
I don't know how else to put it. Like, it got kind of creepy in a couple of places. Am I alone?
No.
Death scene is weird.
Yeah, so I guess that was my eye roll moment. I was like, that. Those are some complicated emotions, and I don't know how to deal with that.
Yeah, that was okay. So that was really, really interesting to me, because I honestly said, this is kind of creepy,
mm-hmm.
but I'm like, am I being too close-minded to understand that this really isn't creepy, because I'm judging her by her appearance, not by her experience and life, you know? And I'm like,
yeah.
Was this something that was intentionally done by Bird and Lindelof because it was shocking, but in almost any other circumstance, it would have been endearing. You know what I'm saying?
Well, but, and it's even creepier because I've seen Ex Machina at this point, so
oh, yeah.
I'll just throw that out there.
That does make it... Well, that would have made it a much more interesting movie if we would have had a similar conclusion that we won't spoil for people who haven't seen that yet. But so, that's funny. I like that both of you come up with kind of come-on moments that hit on the two things that stood out to me when I thought about something that bothered me about this film. And one... staying on the Clooney Athena thing, it wasn't, like I said, the actual romance aspect didn't bother me, but there was this meta thought that I had outside of just the film itself. And the fact that there's already a running joke in Hollywood that George Clooney's love interests keep getting younger and younger. And this just took it to the next level.
Yeah.
And I was like, did no one see like this becoming a joke at the Oscars next year? Because like, I don't know how they don't make this a joke at the Oscars next year or the Golden Globes. It seems more, well, I guess Tina Fey and Amy Poehler won't be hosting the Golden Globes. Anyway, point being, it's ripe for making fun of. The other thing is the Eiffel Tower scene itself as a whole didn't really bother me, but I remember I actually rolled my eyes and I think I said, come on, when they... or Clooney's like showing Edison and Tesla getting along. I was like, even for the sake of utopia, that's a little hard to believe. Anyway, so I like I said, I might have let an audible come on come out. But all right, so like I said, we do that first so we can kind of leave it behind and leave on a high note. So Blaine, why don't you start us off with your favorite part of this movie?
Okay, so I'm going to break the rules.
Wait, we have rules?
I'm going to bend the rules that don't exist, I guess.
Whatever you like about it.
I'm going to make a prediction that I guess is kind of bold. And maybe it's not that bold because I won't live to see it. So I'm a big fan of what C.S. Lewis said when he said you've got to let something live 100 years before you can determine whether it's a classic or not. I kind of like that, especially because I can, you know, say things and then hide behind it and be like, well, I won't live to see it. So I will actually, the film has problems and we've talked about that and it's not perfect, but I think years to come, this movie will be looked on as some sort of classic, whether it's a cult classic. Like, I think it will be significant in years to come. So that's my prediction, for whatever it's worth.
I'm fine with that.
That may make me sound crazy, or I could just be an optimist. But okay, so favorite moment. I'll put a nod to the first time she goes to Tomorrowland. She's not really there, I guess, because it's the pen, and so it's the preview. But I love how that's kind of a one shot there, or it's made to look like a one shot. I thought that was really cool. But really what I loved more than anything else was the Blast from the Past toy shop. There was so much stuff in that toy shop. Like there was an Iron Giant figurine that just made me so happy to see that in there. And there was an Emperor Zurg. I mean, I'm sure there's hundreds of things people will, you know, go back through and pick out in there. But I thought that was just a fun setting. Mm-hmm. And I loved that.
Yeah. Wanted all the things in that shop.
Yeah.
So Joel,
yeah.
What did you like about this film? What thing would you point to?
I also liked the sci-fi shop and was legitimately saddened when they blew it up. There was a moment of deep despair there, thinking all these beautiful toys, you could just save a few.
Yeah, wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Yeah. But actually, it's not necessarily a part, but an actress, and I think Raffi Cassidy as Athena really stood out for me, even more than Clooney and Robertson, and they're, you know, the two main characters, but she just holds her own, and especially with Clooney, even though that is creepy with their kind of strained romance, she just is such an interesting character. Just the way that she thinks and acts and responds and has personality, but also doesn't, because she's a program and recognizes that. If they had just had a movie about her, I thought that would be interesting. And maybe that's what Ex Machina is all about. I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. But I think she as an actress as well is going to go places. And so I'm eager to see what she does next. Because... she's young. She's a young actress who held her own in a film like this. And that's pretty commendable.
Oh, definitely. So, I would say besides taking what I would consider the easy road and say that Brad Bird makes things incredibly visually interesting. Mm. If I didn't take the easy way out and say that as my favorite thing about this movie, I would probably hands down also say that Rafi Cassidy was incredible. Like, I could not stop thinking about, like, it just exactly what you're saying, like how she held her own with like George Clooney, like doing like face to face, back and forths, having to kind of play this very, very tough line between android and lifelike, emotion, non emotion. It was really impressive to me, and I hope it wasn't a one time thing, and I hope that we get more of her and other things, because I think it'll increase the quality of whatever movie she's in.
Mm-hmm.
If that continues.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Are there any other final thoughts that you guys have before we close out? Kind of opening it up. We got one prediction that it's going to be a classic in 100 years.
I guess what I would want to say is that despite the fact that I didn't really like Tomorrowland in a lot of ways, I still have a lot of hope for Brad Bird and whatever he's going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll still go see that in theaters, probably opening weekend. And so even though, I mean, every filmmaker, apart from Brad Bird up until this point, I feel like has some sort of mediocre film or thing that they're not quite as proud of,
mm-hmm.
Or just something that's people didn't get. And I think this is going to be that film. But I could see where Blaine's going to, or that this could be a cult classic in the future, and that people could actually revisit it later on and maybe see some things where predictions came true, or where, you know, one of those things we look back on and be like, whoa, that was ahead of its time. Similar to, boy, this is a crazy comparison, but 2001 A Space Odyssey, when it came out, you know, that people didn't get it back then, and now they love it. You know, it's one of the greatest films of all time. So I could see that happening. But all that to say, I'm just optimistic about Brad Bird still, and still we'll see anything he does.
Yep. So that's kind of what I was planning to leave people with. Ultimately, oh, well, I guess I can put it this way. The film Avenger, who occasionally writes for Real World Theology, did the review of Tomorrowland for the site. And in that review, he kind of lays out something that, Joel, you talked about earlier, laying a lot of the blame of the kind of incoherent parts of this film at the feet of Lindelof instead of laying it at Brad Bird's feet. And, I mean, we all love Brad Bird. I mean, we've all basically talked about how we will go see anything Brad Bird has made. So there is, I think, in full disclosure, a bit of fanboy. Like, we don't want to see Brad Bird do something bad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I think in that review, and it'll be in the show notes, if you go look at what he talks about, like the history of what Brad Bird has done and kind of his vision for things, and if you look at the history of what Lindelof has done, and, you know, we've already mentioned, like, you know, Star Trek Into Darkness, Prometheus, Lost. Like, he is really good at coming up with these kind of mysteries, these big ideas that take you on an adventure that kind of hooks you for a little while, but almost like they almost never pay off in the scope that you would expect them to. And so that kind of follows Lindelof's track record. So I am not in any way deterred from seeing anything Brad Bird does. Because unless he keeps making stuff with Lindelof, then I'm sure that we're going to love it. Because as both of you have said, that, like, you know, Iron Giant is also one of my it might be my favorite animated movie ever. Right now it's sitting in my Letterboxd top 5 or top 4, because I just, every time I see it, it gets me. So mm-hmm. Love Brad Bird, and a little bit of redirection of the blame, but Hopefully Blaine's prediction will be right, and we'll all think fondly on this movie in years to come. But with that, I do appreciate, again, you guys being here, especially finagling you guys at the last minute. So I definitely want to give you guys a chance to kind of promote yourselves. And so, Blaine, how can people find the work that you do? And just what everything, anything that you want people to know about you?
Yeah, you can find, I contribute to realthinking.wordpress.com, and that's real with two E's. And then I tweet occasionally at Department of Tourism.
All right. So make sure you check that out. Make sure I'll have that in the show notes. Joel, first time guest, Joel, great job.
Yeah, thank you.
How can people follow what you do?
You can check out my blog. It's joelmayward.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joel Mayward. And then I have a book coming out on movies this August called Jesus Goes to the Movies, The Youth Ministry Film Guide, which is a movie about, or a book about thinking theologically about movies, particularly for youth pastors, youth workers, parents, teens, and young adults. So you can check that out too.
Nice. And again, I'll make sure we have all those links in the show notes. If you want to, you can follow me at Physification on Twitter. You can follow Real World Theology on Twitter at Real World Theo. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, go to realworldtheology.com. Much like Real Thinking, it's R-E-E-L. And then worldtheology.com. You'll find our show notes. You'll find things about our guests. You'll find all other podcasts we've done. Tons of information. Hopefully you're there already listening to the show. If you're not, it's hopefully because you've either found us on Facebook, which I encourage you to do, or you're listening to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're enjoying it in one of those locations, please review the show. Like I said, bump our rankings. Let's get more people involved in this conversation so we can have another knockdown, drag out fight like we did tonight between these two guys with opposing opinions who pulled no punches, I would say. Well, actually, they were very kind to each other. But with that said, please do that. And thank you so much for making us a part of your week. Thank you so much, Blaine and Joel, for being here. So I got my ending messed up. So I'm just kind of talking in circles now because I was so excited to have everyone here. And so I'm going to stop. I'm going to go back and say, until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye. This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
Damon Lindelof and J.J. Abrams have both talked about this in regards to Lost and their screenwriting stuff, mm-hmm. is they have this thing called a mystery box. Have you guys heard about this? Like the way that they... J.J. Abrams has a TED Talk where he talks about this, and they call it the mystery box, you know, where we show you this box. We tell you something amazing is inside it, but we're not going to tell you or show you what that is until the last minute. And so they pique your interest to the point where you're just, I felt this with Prometheus. Like, I'm just so ridiculously intrigued, right? This is Ridley Scott, and they're bringing back the Alien thing. And I love Alien and Aliens and all that. And I love Ridley Scott's stuff, at least his old stuff, like Blade Runner and Alien. And this is going to be so good. And then you get to the film and it's like, they open the mystery box and it wasn't, the mystery is gone. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of like this big, you know,
that deflating was it, huh?
fart noise. Yeah. It's just, okay.